An executive reversal today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says he wants to keep migrant families together, but it doesn't sound like his zero-tolerance policy is going away. Meanwhile, this emergency room doctor recalls a foster mother bringing in a toddler, the child of a migrant.
She said, "I'm just trying not to ruin his life. I'm just trying not to ruin his life." As she told me that he yelled out every day for his papa, 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 papa.
Plus, is this the sound of the fuel of the future?
So these are the wood pellets. They look like something you'd feed your horse or your pony. So we call them pony nuts.
They're being used in some British power plants, but climate scientists have concerns. That and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. President Trump has signed an executive order. He says it will end the policy of family separation at the border. But there are questions about how that will work and what will happen to the thousands of kids already taken away from their parents. The World's Global Nation editor is Monica Campbell. Monica, what do we know so far about this executive order?
Well, it still emphasizes zero tolerance, that blanket prosecution of people crossing the border for a misdemeanor, put into jail and then into detention center. Now, the real question here is, how are they going to do this if in this executive order, they say they want to keep families together? So if we follow the rhetoric, they want to keep families together and deport them together. But the order says, to the extent permitted by law, and that's where we're going to see some real hurdles, because Obama tried this in 2014. And when you had a lot of people coming across the border from Central America, and he faced real legal obstacles. The question here is, how is the Trump administration going to put families together in jail-like settings, kids together in jail-like settings, considering some of the previous legal hurdles that other administrations faced?
And what will happen to the kids already in the system? Do we know?
The executive order does not address that. So it could be that those kids will be kept where they are now in temporary shelters, long-term shelters. Some kids are already in foster care. Their parents have, many of them have already been deported.
Right. And this is unlikely to be the end of the story. I mean, there are already legal challenges facing different other aspects of family separation. I know you spoke with a lawyer leading the ACLU challenge. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I spoke with Lee Gallant. He's the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrant Rights Project in New York. And one of the plaintiffs in the case is a woman from Congo. She sought asylum at the California-Mexico border, at a port of entry. And that's what the Trump administration is saying people should do. But this family was separated. She was separated from her child. And the ACLU is claiming that was not constitutional. It violated her due process. So here's my conversation with Lee about the case and how he sees some of the troubles going on when it comes to family separations now.
The president does not have the power to engage in these family separations, and that's why we've brought a lawsuit. We filed the lawsuit in March, and at that point, you know, we knew that there were hundreds of family separations. We had no idea that there were going to be this many. We have said that it's unconstitutional for him to separate parents and children. The government has asked that the suit be thrown out. A judge, in very powerful language 2 weeks ago, rejected the government's claim to throw the lawsuit out and said these families do have a constitutional right to be together. And he then went on to say, if the facts alleged by the ACLU in this lawsuit are true, the practice is offensive, brutal, shocks the conscience, tears at the fabric of families and society. So we are now waiting for him to rule on our request for a nationwide injunction to try and substantially end family separation. But let me just emphasize 2 points in response to what Secretary Nielsen's saying and what the Attorney General is saying. First of all, they're saying you won't lose your child if you just go to a port of entry to apply for asylum, present yourself legally at a port of entry. First of all, right now, it's almost impossible to actually present yourself at a port of entry to apply for asylum because they're turning people away. You have families out there sleeping for days and days with little kids trying to be able to apply for asylum and not being able to. But the second point, more fundamentally, is they are separating parents and children who present themselves legally at a port of entry. So it's simply not true that you can avoid separation if you present yourself at a port of entry and don't cross illegally.
Secretary Nielsen says that's not happening.
Yeah, well, that we have people in our lawsuit who presented themselves at a port of entry, and we hear about cases all the time. The last point I want to emphasize, which I think is absolutely critical, is, you know, the secretary says in America, if you commit a crime and go to jail, you're separated from your child because we don't bring children into the jails. The child doesn't follow the parent into jail. But what she's leaving out is the second half of it. In America, when you get out of jail, you get your child back. So these parents are being prosecuted for a misdemeanor, the misdemeanor of illegal crossing. They go to jail for 24 to 48 hours because that's all the judge gives them because it's a misdemeanor. When they get out of jail and go back to ICE custody to pursue their asylum claims, they are not getting their children back. One of the other named plaintiffs in our case got out of jail after time served for the misdemeanor, pursued asylum, passed her initial asylum screening interview, didn't get her child back for 8 months. That is the routine that's going on. So when the secretary says you can't have a kid go into the jail with the parent, maybe so, but what about when the parent gets out of the jail? Why are they not giving the child back? That's what you don't hear the secretary addressing.
So that's Lee Gallant, the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project, speaking with my colleague Monica Campbell. What has the administration had to say about the lawsuit?
Well, we have a request to speak with the administration about this lawsuit. But so far, they say they are on tight legal ground, that they're following the law, that they have the right to prosecute people who cross the border illegally between ports of entry, full stop, that they're following the law, and that is not violating somebody's constitutional rights, and that people are being allowed to seek asylum in the United States. So the pushback on their end is that they're on sound legal ground. ACLU thinks otherwise.
So just a couple more questions, Monica. What can you tell us about how it's decided where these kids go after they've been separated from their families? Because we're about to hear about kids who ended up in Colorado after their families were separated at the border.
By law, children are referred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the Health and Human Services. They're placed in those temporary shelters at the border. And then from there, they're placed in long-term shelters and then eventually placed with a relative in the United States or foster care.
Do we have a sense of how many children end up with parents who are not their parents, parents who foster them?
We don't have hard numbers on that yet, but it's relatively few. I mean, we've seen about 10% are put in foster care, some reports putting it at 10%. It's not a large number, but there are concerns that now with the number of kids being split up from their parents, that you're going to have a foster care system that could get quickly overwhelmed.
The World's Monica Campbell, and let me just add, you're coming back later on the show because there are so many questions about what's going on with these families and kids, and some of the best ones have been coming from you out there. So, Monica, you'll be answering some of them later. For right now, though, Monica, thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Marco.
President Trump said today he wants to do something about the separation of migrant children from their parents, but his administration's policy has already had a very real, some would say lasting, impact on the children who have been through it. Dr. Tara Newbrand has seen it firsthand. She's a pediatrician in Denver, Colorado, and has treated several children whom she believes were separated from their families at the U.S. border.
The first one of these kids I took care of was a little boy from Guatemala.
That little boy, she told us, was between 1 and 2 years old. He's among that small percentage of children we told you about earlier on the show who were put in foster care after being separated from their families. And recently, when that little boy seemed to be coming down with a minor illness, his foster mother brought him to the hospital where Dr. Newbrand works.
In trying to examine him, I noticed that he was very, very, very unusually clingy and physically attached to his foster mother. So much so that she could not put him down. He would not let me examine him easily. And so I asked her a little bit more about if this was going on at home too. And she told me that he had just arrived to her house within the past couple of weeks. And he was like this all the time, 100% of the time. He absolutely would not allow her to put him down. And she got very teary in talking to me And she said, I'm just trying not to ruin his life. I'm just trying not to ruin his life. As she told me that he yelled out every day for his papa, 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 papa. And she couldn't tell him anything about where his papa was or when he might be able to see him again.
When did this parent start fostering this child? And when was the child separated from their dad at the border?
So I saw them in May, and they told me that this child had come into their home within 2 weeks prior to that. They didn't actually have any information at all on when the child had been separated, where the father was, if the child was going to have any kind of visitation with the father, any kind of contact, any plans for reunification at all. They didn't know any of that information.
How many other children have you treated in recent weeks, children that you're certain have been separated from their parents?
I have seen three, and all three of the children that I saw were between one and two. That was their age range. And toddlers, you know, even when they come to the emergency room, they run around, they play, they climb on the bed, they jump off the bed, they play with the toys on the walls. And all of these kids were just clutching their foster mothers. Another one of the children that I saw, the little girl, was also clutching tightly to her foster mother as the first one had been. And the foster mother asked me, you know, if I had any suggestions about how she could bathe her properly. She couldn't put her in the bathtub safely because the child would scream and yell every single time she tried to put her down. And she told me that normally she would, with her biological children, she would just get into the bathtub with the child. But as a foster parent, that's not something that she was allowed to do. So she didn't know what to do for just, you know, a basic hygiene issue for this kid.
Even though she had been experienced as a foster parent for many years.
Right, right. I mean, she did, you know, she was doing the best she could. She was giving the child sponge baths, you know, those types of things.
Yeah.
But she asked me if I had suggestions, and I didn't. I did not have any idea what to tell her.
So not being able to give any advice to that mother about how to bathe her kid, I mean, how did that make you feel as a doctor? I mean, a lot of people turn to doctors because you have the answers.
Yeah, it was awful. I advocate for kids. That is my only job. I do not have another job. And it was really hard. I really had nothing I could give these families to make this better for them.
So surely you're seeing the news. You know that there are lots of kids, 2,000 plus now, who've been separated from their parents since May. What is your biggest concern as a pediatrician, like short-term and long-term impacts?
Well, my biggest concern is that the separation that these kids are going through is going to cause them really significant trauma, and it's going to cause them lifelong health problems. As a medical professional, I'm particularly concerned that when these children are entering, at least the ones that I have seen, the families are not being given any information on the child's medical background, family history, allergies, immunization history. And that's a dangerous thing for kids. I also am very worried that the children and the foster families who are taking care of them don't seem to have any information on any sort of process for reunification with their biological families. It makes it very hard for them to counsel these kids and comfort them through what is a really emotionally difficult time, because they can't tell the kids where the end point is.
That's Dr. Tara Newbrand. She's a pediatrician in Denver, Colorado. She spoke with us earlier today before we got word about President Trump's executive order on migrant family detention policy. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Coal power is on its way out in the country where it was born. For a highly polluting fuel, coal did have a solid 300-year run. But the government of the United Kingdom has promised to phase out coal by 2025. Instead, the UK is focusing on lower carbon energy sources like nuclear, wind, and solar. But there's also one you might not have heard of. And it's got people on both sides of the Atlantic arguing over whether or not it's really a step forward. We're going to tag team our report from our Livable Planet desk today. In a moment, we'll hear from James Morrison in North Carolina. But let's start with our own Carolyn Beeler in Yorkshire, England.
The 12 cooling towers at the Drax power plant have dominated the flat North Yorkshire countryside for decades. The power station was built in the 60s to burn coal from local mines, and it's the largest in the UK. For years, it was a symbol of how important coal is to Britain. But 5 years ago, it started phasing out coal and switching to a different fuel, wood.
So these are the wood pellets. They look like something you'd feed your horse or your pony, so we call them pony nuts.
That's tour guide Jane Breach shaking a plastic bottle of wood pellets in the plant's visitor center.
And they are made from the low-grade wood, so it's dried and powdered, and then it's pressed into the pellets.
Drax started switching from coal to wood because the UK government is putting tight restrictions on carbon emissions to help fight climate change.
And so we've converted three of our six generators to run on wood pellets.
Andy Koss is Drax Power's CEO. He is outside in the shadow of four new cathedral-sized pellet storage domes.
This single site produces 15% of the UK's renewable electricity.
Under EU law, biomass is classified as a source of carbon-neutral energy. The pellets are burned, just like coal, and just like coal, that emits carbon dioxide. But Koss says there's a key difference.
With forests, there's a continuous carbon cycle of carbon being absorbed by forests from the atmosphere, and then when we use the wood material, that carbon goes back into the atmosphere. So we have a carbon cycle which ends up as carbon neutral.
This claim that burning biomass is carbon neutral is hotly contested by scientists and activists. We'll hear more about that in a bit. But first, here is what is not contested. Biomass has helped keep the lights on as the UK moves away from coal. And Drax burns more of it than any other power plant in the world.
So on the left, this is we call it Rail Unloading Building 2. So we get about 17 trains a day, 6 days a week.
All full of wood pellets.
Around 90% comes from North America, with the vast majority of that coming from the US.
And that's where this story takes us back to the US. The wood pellet boom is good for some people there, but others argue it's bad for a lot of reasons. For that part of the story, here is my colleague, James Morrison.
Thanks, Carolyn. A lot of those wood pellets get shipped to Drax from this plant in Franklin, Virginia, where bulldozers are moving mountains of wood chips onto a conveyor belt. It's one of seven plants the company Enviva has opened in the southeastern U.S. recently to feed the growing global appetite for wood pellets.
This is where you really have to be careful on the way down.
I'm touring the grounds with Jen Jenkins, Enviva's chief sustainability officer.
About 20% of our incoming wood comes in as byproducts of industrial processing, and that comes in as sawdust or shavings.
Jenkins says another 20 to 30% comes from logging scraps like limbs and treetops, and about half come from whole trees that are too deformed to be used as lumber. Like Andy Koss at Drax, Jenkins says its wood pellets are carbon neutral because forests in this part of the world have been growing and sucking up CO2 for decades.
In other words, forest carbon stocks are increasing and emissions are actually being removed from the atmosphere by the forest carbon.
But many critics say Enviva's claims of sustainable sourcing and carbon neutrality are misleading at best.
I don't know if you can see on that log, there's a little turtle. Another one out there, too.
Adam Collette is walking through a forest of pine, cypress, maple and oak in North Carolina, not far from the Enviva plant. Before long, he arrives in a big clearing full of large tree stumps.
These are old trees. This is an old forest. And I can't imagine that this is the future of green energy.
Collette's with a forest protection group called the Dogwood Alliance. The organization says it's tracked logging trucks carrying whole, mature trees from this patch of forest and others in the region to three Enviva pellet mills. Enviva disputes those claims and says all its wood is sustainably sourced from timber industry waste. And it's not like cutting trees, even old ones, is a new thing around here. These days, though, Collette says forests here are a lot more valuable to society just left alone. But he says the growing demand for wood pellets is just another incentive to cut them down.
We are now opening up a pathway to log natural forest ecosystems that would otherwise be let grow.
Those forest ecosystems do a lot for both people and wildlife. But maybe most valuable these days is their role in storing carbon. And on that key point, critics take strong exception to the claim that wood pellets are a carbon-neutral fuel.
That's just not correct.
John Sturman is a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He recently published a life cycle analysis of wood bioenergy.
And what we found is that, contrary to your intuition, burning wood to make electricity in places like the Drax power plant actually makes climate change worse for the rest of the century.
Sturman says in the short term, at least, burning wood pellets adds more carbon to the atmosphere than coal. Sure, he says that carbon can be sucked back up by new trees, but he says that can take more than 100 years.
Even if you were to later get the benefits of that carbon being pulled out of the air by forests regrowing, you've made the climate worse, and those impacts persist for hundreds of years.
Many other researchers largely agree with Sturman's findings, but other studies support the industry view. Ultimately, the difference largely comes down to what factors you look at and over what length of time. And for now, at least, many governments seem enthusiastic about using wood to generate electricity. U.S. EPA Chief Scott Pruitt has declared biomass to be carbon neutral. And back across the Atlantic, the EU recently reaffirmed its position that substituting trees for fossil fuels is good for the climate, which is where I'll hand it back to Carolyn Beeler in the UK.
So that endorsement from the EU, it doesn't just mean that governments here in Europe are okay with biomass fuel. They're actually promoting it with subsidies, roughly $1 billion a year in the UK alone.
The fact that the industry exists at all at the scale that it does is purely because of the subsidies that the UK and other EU governments are putting into biomass.
That's Duncan Brock, a researcher at the Chatham House think tank in London. Like John Sturman at MIT, his research shows that burning biomass often isn't carbon neutral. So he argues taxpayers shouldn't be offering blanket subsidies anymore.
But I think what the government should do is recognize the impact that biomass use is having on the climate and on forests, and restrict the use to that material which has the lowest impact on climate.
Brock says that means only things like sawdust and waste wood. Back at the Drax power plant, CEO Andy Cost says he welcomes this debate over biomass, but the company's issued detailed rebuttals of both Duncan Brock's and John Sturman's research. And their stance is unwavering.
We're very confident that managed forests, grown in a sustainable way and used in a sustainable way, lead to genuine carbon savings.
The scientific jury is still very much out on that. But Drax is charging ahead. It's planning to switch a fourth unit over from coal to biomass this year. Meanwhile, two big biomass plants are in the works in the UK, and the industry continues to expand in Europe and the US.
The World's Carolyn Beeler there in Yorkshire, England, along with James Morrison in North Carolina. I'm Marco Werman. Liu Dinhuang was taken away from his parents and put in immigration detention when he was 9 years old. That was back in 1930.
And I think that, unfortunately, he carried sort of the burden of that shame and fear of America with him when he passed away.
A history lesson for our times that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There's a bridge across the Rio Grande that connects Matamoros, Mexico, with Brownsville, Texas. About 15 immigrants, including women and children as young as 3 years old, are camping out on that bridge, sleeping on pieces of cardboard. They're would-be asylum seekers, and U.S. federal agents have prevented them from crossing to the Texas side of the bridge. Reporter Nina Satija with the Texas Tribune and Reveal has been speaking with those families.
So normally, my understanding is that when you cross from Matamoros, Mexico into Brownsville, Texas, you walk across this bridge, you know, you pay your 25 cents and you can walk all the way across. But actually, there are now CBP agents stationed right at the halfway point. So for the folks that don't have documents to cross, they are stopped by those CBP agents at the halfway point and said, no, you're not allowed to continue. And so that's what's happened to these families, about 15 people or so that we saw yesterday. We saw a handful today as well, who have been denied access to the rest of the bridge. And so they're camping out there on the sidewalk.
And how many days have the Customs and Border Patrol agents been also up on that bridge? And why are they doing this?
All I can tell you is we got here on Tuesday morning. We saw them. We saw them this morning. There have been reports about this happening as early as a couple of weeks ago, including on this port of entry. The families that were camped out there, some of them have been there since Saturday. So I think it's fair to say they've at least been there for a few days. We did try to talk to the CBP agents. They referred us to their supervisors in the office on the other side of the bridge on the U.S. side. They wouldn't talk to us either. So we really don't have any official explanation for this.
Can you tell us, Nina, about one of these people camped out on the bridge, a 20-year-old man from Guatemala named Marcos Samayoa? How was he separated from his wife and children?
Yeah, absolutely. So Marcos is 22 years old, actually, and he came from Guatemala in late April. His family was being threatened. His business was being threatened. So he came over. His wife and four children crossed before him. He doesn't know exactly how they crossed or when they crossed. He knows they were able to get to the U.S. And his understanding from very brief phone conversations with his mother-in-law, who lives in Los Angeles, is that they were actually separated at the border, his wife and their four children. Meanwhile, he is not able to cross the bridge at this point. We just talked to him about an hour ago. He was still waiting on the bridge. He actually slept there last night. That was his third night sleeping there. It was horrible weather conditions. It was raining cats and dogs. There was lightning, thunder, tornado warnings. So he slept there in really terrible conditions and is still hoping to be allowed to cross. But the CBP agents have not given him the green light to do that.
Although, as you point out in your report in the Texas Tribune, Nina, sleeping on that bridge for Marcos Samayoa is preferable to staying in Guatemala. He had gangs that were trying to extort him back there, which I think is kind of extraordinary. Even through the rain, he'd rather be there.
That's what he told us yesterday. Unfortunately, today the situation has changed a little bit. He was able to get back in touch with his mother-in-law, who has now told him that his wife has been denied asylum. She is reportedly in a detention facility in Los Fresnos. She's appealing that asylum decision, but it's not clear whether that will be successful. And their children are still separated. They're not totally sure where their children are. So it's really a terrible situation.
What about life, though, for those three-year-olds on that bridge? I mean, I can't imagine. They don't know what's going on. They're soaking wet, cold probably.
Yeah, the kids are being the best sports that they can about the situation, you know, running back and forth across the bridge, you know, on the Matamoros side before the CBP agents stop them from going further. You know, there are public bathrooms everyone can use, again, on the Matamoros side towards the end of the bridge, just walking back and forth, trying to keep themselves entertained. Certainly the kids are getting sick. We saw one family walk over to the Mexican side to seek some medical attention. They came back with a bag full of medicine given to them, I believe, by some Mexican government officials. Mm.
These migrants on the bridge, did you get any sense speaking with them that they know about this policy of separating families?
We did ask Marcos that question, as well as some other families that were there. They didn't appear to be aware. Of course, Marcos knew that his wife and children had been separated, but he did not know that that was an official policy. So it doesn't seem that that news has really made it to the other side of the border. Although I expect that even if it had, I'm not sure that these families would have really believed it or absorbed that information, to be honest with you.
Reporter Nina Satija with the Texas Tribune and Reveal, speaking with us from Brownsville, Texas. Nina, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is not America, people are writing all over Twitter, and yet it is America. We've been here before, like in 1930. That's when a 9-year-old boy named Liu Dinhuang was separated from his family and placed in immigration detention. He and his brother had left China to join their father in San Francisco, but that was at a time when the Chinese Exclusion Act, we spoke recently on the show about this law, it barred nearly all Chinese immigrants from coming to the U.S. And Liu Dinhuang's experience being separated from his family and interrogated by officials stayed with him his whole life. It's a story that's recently been on his granddaughter's mind a lot. Princeton University history professor Beth Lou Williams, thanks very much for joining us. When you were growing up, how much did you know about your grandfather's story about arriving in the U.S.? Or is this something you only learned as an adult?
You know, I didn't know very much about his story as I was growing up. I would see him mostly in these crazy family gatherings. And, you know, he would call me over and talk to me about the value of family. And he mentioned Angel Island, but I didn't at the time really know what it meant.
So take us back to 1930. How did your grandfather end up at the Angel Island immigration station?
He was born in China, but his father and his older brother had been living in America. And in 1930, when he was 9 years old, his brother, who was an adult, went back to China to fetch him. And when they arrived in San Francisco, his brother was allowed to land. But he was diverted to Angel Island Immigration Station, where he was detained and interrogated by the immigration officials.
Did he ever talk to you about what that interrogation was like?
Yes, I went and talked to him in 2002, just a couple weeks before he died. And he actually failed the first round of interrogation. Officials at the time would ask very detailed questions about your family and your upbringing. And he talked about a parade that he had gone to as a child, I think sort of off the cuff in the middle of the interrogation. And it was something that his brother and his father knew nothing about. And for that reason, immigration officials didn't believe his story that he was related to his own father and his brother.
So Liu Dinh-Wing was separated from his family. Was there a specific policy that called for that separation at the time?
There was not a specific policy or law that called for Chinese immigrants to be separated when they arrived. However, it became sort of routine because these officials wanted to make sure that Chinese immigrants weren't able to coordinate their stories.
Back in 2002, you spoke to your grandfather about his experience and recorded it. What did he tell you about his time at the detention center on Angel Island?
You know, he described Angel Island as both a very boring place and a very scary place. It was boring because you woke up to the sound of a bell, you ate at the time of a bell, and it was a routine that was sort of relentless. But he also talked about it as scary because the detainees themselves were very anxious. He witnessed fights. He talked about food being stolen from him. It was very scary to him.
So I want us to hear a bit of your grandfather talking. This is in 2002 before he passed, and this is about being separated from his family.
Some of those people in there, been there 1-2 years, the one that couldn't get in or get the other shipped out. Some of them have got the right thing. They're gone into the States already. I was one of those unlucky ones that stayed 9 to 12 months. I don't even know how long. I was the youngest one.
Wow, 9 to 12 months in detention. Did you ever find out more about that?
Yes. A few years after he died, I learned how to request his immigration file. And so much of it was exactly as he had described it. The name of the ship, the interrogation questions that he got wrong. But I remember being shocked when I read that he had only been detained on Angel Island for 34 days. And it took me a moment to realize what that meant, that 34 days was a lifetime for this 9-year-old. You know, he had been separated from his family, he had been detained, and he was interrogated all alone. It was traumatic.
Yeah. How do you think all of this weighed on this 9-year-old as he started to grow older? I mean, what was the long-term impact of being detained for over a month?
You know, it's hard to say in part because this was not the end of his troubles. He had a hard life. He fought in World War II for the U.S. He came back and he worked, you know, 12 hours a day as a cook. You know, he was not a happy man, at least for a long time. That really changed when he became a grandfather. I think that he sort of reconnected with family and understood what family meant in a very different way. But I could still see the trauma of that time on Angel Island when I went and saw him that last time before he died. Because, you know, I recorded his life story, but then afterwards he asked me to turn off the tape recorder and he talked more. And he wanted the tape recorder off in part because he was still ashamed and he was still scared from his time on Angel Island. He thought that some part of America still did not want him, and that his trauma, his time there, had somehow been deserved. And I think that, unfortunately, he carried sort of the burden of that shame and fear of America with him when he passed away.
So your own story, your own family's history, your grandfather's story, how is that affecting your view with this new Trump immigration policy that is also separating children from their families?
Well, I'm just so upset. You know, I have children. I actually have, you know, a shy, happy 9-year-old boy. And it hurts me so much to imagine what it would be like to have him separated from me and detained. I mean, in some ways, I can't imagine. And then in other ways, I can imagine because I saw, you know, this 81-year-old man still talking about the trauma of this experience. You know, and his experience in 1930 was relatively rare, but suddenly this policy of zero tolerance has made the numbers of children experiencing this so much more. It's just horrifying.
Princeton University history professor Beth Lou Williams talking about her grandfather, Lou Dinh-Wing, who was detained when he arrived in the United States in 1930. Thank you very much, Beth.
Thank you.
That story was made possible by our Global Nation Reporting Fund. In Miami, a Spanish language play has been running since January to sold out crowds. And until recently, one of the main characters was played by a fair-skinned actress in blackface. Blackface was popular and acceptable in some parts of the U.S. well into the 1950s, but it still performed in Spanish language entertainment. And Afro-Latinos in Florida say this latest example is a window into the racism that persists in Latin American communities. WLRN's Nadege Green tells us more.
Nerida Rodriguez is 66 years old. She grew up in Cuba. When she was a little girl, segregation was still enforced.
It was like a clubhouse for whites and clubhouse for blacks.
She says after the Cuban Revolution, even with promises of racial harmony and anti-discrimination laws, racism against black Cubans continued.
White Cubans, they tell you there was no racism in Cuba. There was and there is racism among the Cuban people.
So when she read in El Nuevo Herald, a Miami newspaper, about a Cuban play in Miami that depicted a non-black actress in blackface, she was not surprised.
I'm a black woman. It's not like we're offended now. We always been offended.
The play is Tres Viudas en un Crucero, Three Widows on a Cruise. In this promotional video, the blackface character, with exaggerated big red lips, pounds her chest and jokes about playing like three gorillas. The director of the play could not be reached for comment. Teatro Trail, the theater where it's being shown, did not respond to interview requests. In a statement posted online, the theater said its intent was not to offend any race and that it will no longer show the character in blackface. This change of heart came only after reporter Brenda Medina wrote an article about the play for El Nuevo Herald.
They tackle every black stereotype, you know, that you can possibly imagine. Blacks don't work. They're not that smart.
After Medina's story ran, people were outraged, but the play had its supporters too. Medina received emails calling her racist.
As a black Dominican woman, I have had personal attacks, calling me ignorant, telling me that I just don't understand Cuban theater, that the story is racially charged, coming from my racial trauma.
And supporters of the play kept telling her this was tradition. For many Afro-Latinos in South Florida, it's not just about this play.
I'm hoping that this is part of a larger conversation about intra-Latino racism and what the experiences are of black Latinos and how that experience seems to be invisible.
Danielle Cleland is Afro-Puerto Rican, and she's a professor at Florida International University.
The, you know, majority white exile population has created this idea that Latino in Miami means white.
Cleland's research focuses on Afro-Latinos in Latin America and in the U.S.
It's ironic because if you go to Puerto Rico or if you go to Cuba or if you go to the Dominican Republic, right, or the majority of the population has Afro-descendancy, but that seems to be lost in Miami.
I remember being told as a child, dañate la raza, meaning that you messed up the race.
Messed up the race because Rudy Vizcaíno has dark skin. He's half Cuban and half Dominican. And he's chairman of the Dominican American National Foundation.
Dominicans have a saying, mejorar la raza. And you make the race better by marrying and having children with white people.
Similar sentiments are common in other Spanish-speaking countries, too. And they plant the seed early on that blackness is something to be rejected.
Levin, I wore a T-shirt that said, I am the Afro-Latino American dream. And then I remember bumping into an uncle of mine that's Cuban. He told me, take off that shirt. You're not African. I said, hey, Theo, you know, last time I checked, you know, I always say I can be born a thousand times, I'd want to be black. I wouldn't have it any other way.
After the backlash about staging a play with the character in blackface, the Miami Theater, Teatro Trail, now says it's planning a conference this month hosted by Afro-Latinos to discuss cultural sensitivity. For The World, Nadege Green, Miami.
We opened the show today talking about family separation, and it's on so many people's minds. We're going to try to answer some of your questions about this practice. Joining me again is our Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell. So, Monica, one question we received from several listeners is, what is the plan for tracking and reuniting these children with their parents?
Well, it's very difficult when the parents and children are put on separate tracks. Parents are criminally prosecuted, they're put into marshal's custody, and then they're placed in an ICE facility, a detention center, while the child is put in a separate shelter and then perhaps put into a longer-term shelter or placed with a relative in the United States. So what you have are parents and children put on separate tracks. So bringing parents and children split up back together gets really complicated when a parent is in a detention center for adults only.
Yeah, well, this executive order is aimed at not separating families. Part of it is going to have to find a solution to addressing what we've been talking about there. Another listener, Michael Kaiser in Maryland, was puzzled by the use of the term federal misdemeanor, referring to people being inside the U.S. without papers. What are the crimes, Monica, fall into this category of federal misdemeanor?
Okay, so a Class B misdemeanor, this is not even like the strongest misdemeanor. It's a Class B misdemeanor. It's a first-time DUI. It's a low-level drug possession. And it generally, if you're shoplifting and you've shoplifted something under about $500, you're going to get charged with a Class B misdemeanor.
All right, one more question from another listener, this one from Rob Meyer in St. Paul, Minnesota. He asks, if these people are just trying to get away from a bad situation, why do they not stop as soon as they get out of the country? Why do they not land in Belize or Costa Rica or Mexico? Those countries have similar climates and language and cultures. Monica?
I think it speaks to the ties that the United States has with the rest of the world, particularly parts of Latin America. You cannot travel in Central America or Mexico and not find somebody who has not just one, but several family members in the United States. So if you're fleeing your country and you've got an aunt, say, in Florida or an uncle or a brother in California saying, hey, I got a room here. And you know what? You can get a job and start working here in a couple of weeks. You're going to go there. And you might also be thinking longer term about your children. Your children can go to school in the United States. There are things that can benefit long-term a family in the United States that can make a lot of sense instead of going to a place like Mexico or somewhere else where they may have no family ties.
Monica, I'm sure we'll keep getting more questions and we'll be turning to you again for help answering them. The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
To send us your questions, email us at theworld, that's one word, theworld@pri.org. Okay, what's the friendliest country for immigrants on Earth? According to the 2017 Migrant Acceptance Index, a Gallup survey, it is Iceland. Iceland may be historically isolated and a culturally homogenous island, but it's also been seeing an ever-increasing number of immigrants over the past decade. My BBC colleague Valeria Parasa was recently in Iceland looking at how the survey matches how migrants are actually settling in.
This survey is gauging people's acceptance of migrants based on questions such as, would you mind an immigrant becoming your neighbor or marrying into your family? Or what would you think of migrants living in this country? Are they a good thing or not? And it's not the only poll in which Iceland came with top marks. There's another poll from the University of Iceland recently that showed that 60% of people are very welcoming and accepting of immigrants, and they think that they bring positive change to society. And I think the reasons for this are the booming economy. Iceland has gone from being one of the poorest countries in Europe to being one of the richest over the past half a century. And with this comes a need for manpower. There's an acute labor shortage in the Icelandic market, so they need workers.
Tell me about the range of people you met and why they chose to move to Iceland.
Well, the largest group comes from Poland. They are almost 40% of all immigrants, a huge percentage. Lithuania and the Philippines, those are the two countries that follow Poland. And now there's a more recent Spanish-speaking population, both from Spain and from Latin America, but that's a lot more recent. And this was basically economic migrants who came to work in fisheries, for example, which are the backbone of Icelandic economy. But then there's a more recent flow of foreigners who are young, who define themselves as globetrotters or world travelers and come here for a variety of reasons. But jobs still seem to be the main draw. I talked to a guy from Spain, for example, who moved here after the economic crisis.
In Reykjavik, I've been offered stability as well as fair and equal treatment to that of other workers, regardless of where they come from. For the first time, I feel valued, not like in Spain, where we really have to fight for our rights ever since the economic crisis began there. Here, I feel very valued.
So, Valeria, I know from personal experience that Iceland is a very expensive country to visit. How do migrants on tight budgets cope with that?
The average salary is still very high, so it's almost $3,000 per month, which puts Iceland among the highest salaries in Europe. And obviously migrants working there get a salary that is on par with the cost of living. But they also complain that it's very high, that sometimes they struggle to save money. And obviously this affects especially those who are in low-skilled jobs.
So I have to ask you about two things that might throw visitors to Iceland off. One is the language, the other is the weather. Start with the language. How are people learning Icelandic for the first time? How are they coping?
Not very well, apparently. It was very interesting that most of them said that learning the language was the most difficult thing for them living there. And it was also the main barrier for integration. This has to do with the fact that Icelandic language is very complicated. It's considered one of the toughest to learn for English speakers. And one of the reasons why it's so hard to learn the language is because people there want you to speak it perfectly or not speak it at all. One woman I spoke to, Viola Uchadowska from Poland, was finding the language very difficult to learn, as I said.
I noticed one thing that, of course, they are encouraging to learn the language, but actually, at one point, it is amazingly hard to like go forward with it. So then you're not going to get some kind of jobs and stuff like that. And the language is like the national treasure.
What about the weather? I mean, it's long winters, can be bone-chillingly cold.
Yes, there is a saying in Iceland that if you don't like the weather, just wait for 5 minutes. But of course, in winter, it changes from bad to worse,
right.
Really. I know that from experience. And some people struggled more with the weather than others, obviously.
How are Icelanders, though, reacting to this changing population, now 11% of the island? Because in many parts of the world, Valeria, as you know, populism is on the rise, and in many cases it's a response to immigration.
There is a small movement here that also would rather not see the society changing. But overall, as the polls show, most people feel that they have a lot to gain from people settling there. And overall, Icelandics are very prosperous. They top every possible ranking when it comes to well-being, development, gender equality, etc. And with this refugee crisis becoming a global issue, they are aware that they need to respond.
My BBC colleague, Valeria Perasso, thanks very much for telling us about your trip to Iceland.
Thank you.
And we're signing off from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.